I am young, and the young do not number many here, but it is fair to say we have the run of the place.
Hello and welcome to this short fiction masterclass brought to you by Threshold's International Short Story Forum in collaboration with the Charleston Trust. My name's Jack Catania and I'm at the Small Wonder Festival talking to Colin Barrett, who has just won the prestigious Frank O'Connor Award for his debut collection, Young Skins. The prize's judges said Young Skins has all the hallmarks of an instant classic. Are you pinching yourself?
Of course I am. Yeah, I mean, I'm making the shortlist was left me ecstatic, so it's actually when it was crazy.
And we're going to start off with your reading us the opening of the first story in the collection, The Clancy Kid. So will you take it away?
My town is nowhere you have been, but you know its ilk. A roundabout off a national road, an industrial estate, a five-screen cineplex, a century of pubs packed inside the square mile of the town's limits. The Atlantic is near, the gnarled jawbone of the coastline, with its gull-infested promontories is near. Summer evenings and in the manure-scented pastures of the satellite parishes, the Zen bovines lift their heads to contemplate the V8 howls of the boy racers tearing through the back lanes. I am young, and the young do not number many here, but it is fair to say we have the run of the place. It is Sunday. The weekend, that three-day festival of attrition, is done. Sunday is the day of purgation and redress, of tenderized brain cases and seesawing stomachs and hollow pledges to never ever get that twisted again, a day you are happy to see slip by before it ever really gets going. It's well after 8 p.m., though still bright out, the warm light infused with that happy kind of melancholy that attends a July evening in the West. I am sitting with Tug Cunniff at a table in the alfresco smoking area of Dockery's pub. The smoking area is a narrow concrete courtyard to the building's rear, overlooking the town river. Midges tickle our scalps. A candy-striped canvas awning extends on cantilevers, and now and then the awning ripples sail-like in the breeze. Ours is the table nearest to the river, and it is soothing to listen to the radiostatic bristle of the rushing water. There are a dozen other people out here. We know most of them, at least to see, and they all know us. Tug is one many prefer to keep a tidy berth of. He's called Manchild behind his back. He is big and he is unpredictable, prone to fits of rage and temper tantrums. There are the pills he takes to keep himself on an even keel, but now and then in a fit of contrariness, or out of a sense of misguided self-confidence, he will abandon the medication. Sometimes he'll admit to the abandonment and sell me on his surplus of pills, but other times he'll say nothing.
Thank you. The Clancy Kid is about two friends. The narrator's friend Tug is obsessed with a missing child who's gone missing from the town. And yet that's not really what the story's about. The story's about growing up and not growing up. Tug is a man-child. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you felt you were exploring in the story.
That's a good question. As you pointed out there, the story, the kind of hook, the title is ostensibly about this child that goes missing, the Clancy Kid. A story the character Tug is kind of obsessed with. And then, you know, at the same time, it's not really about that at all. It is about friendship between Tug and his friend Jimmy, the narrator. And they're two characters who are a little bit out of time. They're in the place that they know, the only place they've ever been in, the small town they've grown up in. And yet, at the same time, they're in a kind of exile, adulthood, or that kind of long, indefinite space between childhood and adulthood.
Yes.
That they've got a purgatory they've kind of been exiled to, the two of them. And so they're kind of just, they're waiting it out to
yes.
see what will happen. And when you're in that sort of condition of existential arrest,
yes.
like Tug and Jimmy are, your kind of eccentricities and your perversities and your peculiarities, I think, are the only things you can cling on to.
Yes.
They're two misfits on a very obvious level, and like a lot of the characters in the other stories, they couldn't survive anywhere else.
So
they can't even envisage being anywhere else, rather. So they stay where they've always known.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still at a place. There's still a sort of, you know, an inextricable sense of displacement that they can't quite fit themselves back into.
Yes.
So the story was about that, really. It's just, I mean, that's all you need if you're going to, you know, and hopefully you can get something resonant from that, you know.
I think what you talked about is the relationship between the two is really interesting to me, because there are a lot of characters that have that kind of relationship, don't they? They're waiting it out. They are in this sort of limbo state, but it's not just Tug and Jimmy who are. There's Dimpner and Arm, for example. There's the two characters in the final story, Duran and Eli. Do you think you have a particular interest in this kind of relationship between men, young men?
Yeah, I mean, you discover these things as you kind of write
yes.
the story, you know. I kind of never thought in advance, well, I'm going to write a sequence of stories about, you know, pairings of young men who are
yes.
you know, who are kind of in a state of limbo. But that is how it happened, and it was interesting to me that I discovered that that's how I did it. There was lots of pairings in almost every one of the stories. There's a narrator, or there's a main character, and a sort of he's got a male friend, and I suppose on the simplest level, that was just to, on a technical level, in a narrative, it's a way of just exploring, you know, a dichotomy or dual
yes.
halves of a relationship. One character is not like the other. One's perceptive and maybe passive, and the other sort of blunders along. And I mean, that's just
the
a simple
unique
narrative.
Characters of both, each single character has a uniqueness that is exposed through the other, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, one shines a light in the other. They can't. Most of the characters. The stories aren't novels, and I think direct psychological exploration
yes.
of characters doesn't. You know, it's not really what the short story. Is best at, I think you can distill a character down to their soul, down to their kernel in short stories in a way you can't with novels. But you have to sort of clarify things and simplify things and keep characters, allow them, as I've said it before, I allow them the integrity of their sort of enigmatic nature.
Yes.
I don't try and psychoanalyze the characters. I just let them be in act. And so you can let them be in act when you have another character
yes.
that their behaviour is contextualised by,
yeah.
Without glibly going into the exactly, you know, what their, you know, childhood trauma is or whatever,
yes.
you know. So the short story is a much more, it distills things, and it's a form that requires you to purify and simplify.
Yes.
And so having these pairings of characters allowed me to, you know, hopefully come up with something insightful or resonant about a character without explaining them away.
Yes, and I think you've achieved that in a fine balance of that sort of characterization, exposition, and showing, and dialogue plays a large part of that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, many short story writers I love and admire. When I started out reading them, I kind of thought, well, I want to do all the things they're doing. And I saw, the first thing you notice when you read a writer is all the things they're doing on
yes.
the page. They're, you know, they might have really strong figurative language, certain poetic density, dialogue, vernacular is very, very important, both from a tradition of Irish writing and the American Southern writers I was influenced by, Flannery O'Connor, etc. Right, brilliant dialogue. But then I kind of realised what all these great writers weren't doing, how much you can leave out, how much
yes.
you can leave out in a short story. It's astonishing what you can leave out, and yet still completely nail a character to the page, or you know.
Absolutely.
It still astonished me. Yeah, it still astonished me how much you leave out, you know, and that's what you have to learn, to leave out stuff. And so I tried in these stories to, not entirely, you know, you can always leave out more, I think you can always pare it down more, but I was amazed at how much I could just let go. You know, some of the stories would start out with loads of exposition and just jettison it all, and you can encapsulate all that in an image or an exchange of dialogue.
Yes. And in the description of sometimes the scenery comes to life almost as a character, sometimes the environment and the fictional town that you've invented. So all these stories are set in the town of Glanby, which is in County Mayo, but it isn't. And I love the way it's described in that very first page, the gnarled jawbone of the coastline with its gull-infested promontories. And I just wondered how the setting emerged. Did it emerge all at once for you? I know you've spoken in the past of how you can shift around because, you know, you don't have to pin it to an actual place.
Yeah.
But did it kind of, at which point did you decide that they were all set in the same town? At what point did the setting emerge?
It emerged gradually. I mean, I was writing a few years back, it was a few years ago now, and I was doing what people do. You write stories, some don't work out, and some are about different characters, and they were set in different places. But the stories that were working the best and the ones that had a certain kind of energy were set in a rural sort of west of Ireland coastal town, provincial town, and I kind of realised they were the stories that were working the best. And as a matter of expediency, as much as anything else, I kind of decided to set them in the same fictional town. Rather, I guess the only choice you have is you can either set it in a real life town, as it were, or you fictionalise the setting. And so with the short stories, I wasn't going to fictionalise seven different rural west of Ireland towns. It was too specific. But at the same time, this was maybe two or three stories in, I kind of settled on Glan Bay, and once I did that, not only were they the stories that were working, but just sort of having this place fixed in my mind and building it slowly, story by story, line by line, was just incredibly generative and powerful. It just gave me energy, it gave the stories energy. It just sort of lit up the characters and the stories, and so it was incredibly important, just the sense of place. And it's just something you build as you go along.
Yeah.
It wasn't even a conscious thing. It was just you needed to see the landscape. Again, just talking about the sort of poetic intensity of the short story form, the way it concentrates things.
Sometimes there are just a couple of images in a story that kind of resonate long after you've finished reading the story. The drama of the story resonates, but also those images.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I really write for, those kind of images, those little moments of either familiarity or kind of estranging beauty where you see something like you've never seen it before. You can only do that through language.
Yeah.
That's what I love about writing. And in short stories, because of the concentratedness of the form, none of those images are wasted, as in poetry. There's no stray similes or metaphors. There's no stray figurative language. There's no stray dialogue. It all falls back in, into the story, which is what separates it from longer narratives, perhaps, where descriptive writing can sometimes just be descriptive writing.
Yeah.
It isn't in a short story. It shouldn't be anyway, and it should do its work exactly.
Yes. Great. And I think, for me, it struck me that you write men particularly well. All your main characters are men, we'll come to that in a bit. But you managed to show this kind of curious blend of machismo and vulnerability. It feels like a balance. It feels like something that is achieved through craft. It doesn't feel that it's just naturally popped onto the page. Is that so? Do you work with characters to expose them, or do you find that they just expose themselves as you write?
As I said, I they're all my characters are fascinating to me, certainly at the outset when I'm writing them, because I don't understand them. And one of the earliest stories, The Moon, has Val Neary, the bouncer, nightclub bouncer, and he's a kind of character I would have encountered dozens of times without ever really getting to know them in where I grew up. This, big fish in a small pond, but kind of Val happens to be quite content with his position. He's trying very assiduously to not be a misfit.
Yes.
And is trying to convince himself he's perfectly happy where he is. And it was just that sort of, story, for instance, I just started off with that character standing at that door, and I felt like it could have gone either way, but I wanted to, I just think you have to, I think it's almost your duty to try and, give your characters dimensionality and depth, and but do it by letting them be themselves. Try and not to force them with a plot or I just didn't want to talk down to any of the characters.
Yeah,
if you know what I mean. Obviously, you young men, you're working with certain tropes, and you know it's exactly what you said. You know, the machismo versus the sort of, you know, some unarticulated or damaged, fragile aspect that
but
most
also
men
longing,
have.
Terrible longing.
Yeah, well, men have feelings. You know, there's.
I know.
Men have feelings. Women have feelings.
So beautifully. I mean,
well,
you know, he starts up with the starts up with the pubic hair in his tooth.
Yeah.
And you just think, and he's so dismissive about it when he pulls it out, and you just think, oh, I don't like this character.
Yeah.
And then gradually you realise he's just filled with longing for Martina, the girl that
who probably
will never really pin down.
Or oh, no,
she's moving
never.
Out of
she's,
his orbit.
She's running rings around him, you know. But, yeah, it was just to take those sort of stock characters almost. And, you know, there's the low-level drug dealers, the sort of the misfits, the guy who works in the petrol station, Bat, and to sort of give them a bit of just explore them really. I don't want to say give them their humanity. That sounds awful, but people, people have feelings. People have an interior life. They may not have the language necessarily to articulate it, and they may not have the milieu in which that articulation will be appreciated, especially in all male environments, or you know, but that doesn't mean they don't have those feelings. And I know men do. I know everyone does. So I didn't really have any, whether by ignorance or accidental confidence, I had no hesitation about sort of taking those kind of characters and making them the focus of the stories. I knew the stories would work with those characters.
Yes.
That I would do everything I wanted to do in a story with them.
And you do take the reader right with you. And I think one of the kind of strongest examples of that is when you take a character who is the strong man for a drug dealer.
Yeah.
You know, he's the muscle. And you give him his humanity and you take him on quite a terrible journey. So I was hoping that you'd read us the beginning of Calm with Horses.
Yes. Dimna told Arm to stay in the car, while Dimna gave Fannigan a chance to plead his case. This wasn't the way it usually went, but Arm nodded, okay. Arm watched Dimna stalk up the lawn and politely hammer on the front door of the council house Fannigan shared with his mother. Eventually, Dimna was let inside. Arm slid in his earphones and sank in the passenger seat. The car was originally Dimna's Uncle Hector's, a battered cranberry Corolla Dimna dubbed the shitbox, its interior upholstered in tan vinyl that stank of motor oil, cigarette ash and dog. Recessed into the dash was a dead radio, its cassette tape slot jammed with calcified gobs of blue tack, cigarette butt ends and pre-Euro-era Irish coins. The dash smelled of fused electricals. Above Arm's head, a row of memorial cards, their laminate covers wilted by age and light, were tucked into the sun visor, and a red beaded rosary chain was tangled around the inverted T of the rearview mirror. Three houses down, two schoolgirls were sitting on a garden wall talking and smoking. They were in their teens, their figures swollen to shapelessness by puffer jackets and the voluminous skirts of navy and green convent plaid heaped up in their laps. It was 10 on a Wednesday morning, and the girls, Arm figured, were mitching from school. They were sharing the one cigarette, passing it back and forth and gabbing and rocking their feet from side to side in insistent tandem. Their heads were bent low. They covered their mouths as they spoke, each the other's confidant. And Arm could have happily sat and watched them for the rest of the morning, but he sensed movement from Fannigan's house. Dimna was stomping back down the lawn in a way that reminded Arm of his own little boy, Jack. Dimna loomed by the passenger window, made a gun shape with his finger and pointed at Arm's head. Arm popped out his earphones. Dimna's features, which always looked too small for his wide face, were pinched, consternated. His tracky top was zipped right up to his neck, and Arm watched the zipper shiver tautly against the knot of his Adam's apple. Dimna let out a long sigh like a mammy. arm, get in there and beat the fuck out of that daft man. What about the mother? Arm said. Dimna held up and opened his left hand. A key adhered to his clammy palm. I put her in the bathroom. Fannigan agreed that was best. Gave me a hand getting her in there. He's waiting for you in the sitting room. Is it going to make it awkward, you reckon? Arm said. Dimna ran his right hand over the ginger stubble on top of his head, shaved so tight it shone like vapour in the morning light. You never know, but I don't think so. He knows it'll go over easier if he just takes it. How easy should it go? Arm asked. Dimna smiled wanly. Well, don't kill him.
Thank you. It's an extraordinary story, and the violence builds. It builds, and it slowly but surely escalates until Arm is destroyed by it. He's instigated it. In the beginning of the story, he's acting for somebody else, and then he becomes an actor in the story. And yet, you never lose sympathy for him as a reader, because he has another side to him, and the side to him that shows tenderness for his young son, and the side to him that is actually bewildered by the path his life seems to be taking, even though he's making choices along the way. And I think what makes this story bearable to read, and even enjoyable to read, strangely, is the humour that you infuse it with. The humour, there's an absurdity in these situations, you know, the guy's about to be beaten up, helping his mother into the bathroom to be locked in there while he's being beaten up. Yeah. But also in the idiolect, in the kind of turn of phrase in the language of your characters. And I was wondering, when you're writing a story like this, a story that has brutality at its heart, are you conscious of balancing the light and the dark? Is it something that you put in the editing process, or does the humour naturally arise as you write?
It naturally arises, I guess, because it's kind of what I grew up with. It does naturally arise. I mean, I think all the stories are quite funny.
Yeah, they are.
It's dark humour, but I think they're all quite funny. Humour is integral part of any good, serious, good work, I think. Mm-hmm. And in Cam with Horses, I guess, yeah, it is a story that goes, it escalates up, it opens out a little. I mean, it's novella length, it's 72 pages, so it gives you that breath to open it out before it closes back up again. And the character of Arm is, again, just a kind of a personality I'm kind of just familiar with. This person is incredibly physically capable and physically dangerous, but at the same time just a person of contradictions, at the same time completely passive and waits to be told what to do, and when he acts of his own volition, acts catastrophically. He switches off when he's being violent. I mean, he just does it mechanically.
Yes. He's a trained fighter. Yeah,
so he does it
with
that.
Learned to do.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not not fighting, but I mean, I'm always I grew up in a very sort of GAA Irish football, the indigenous game. I just grew up in a kind of athletic sort of where athletics are prized, and the best. I mean, I played, but I wasn't very good. It was terrible. But I mean, the best. I could never lose my self consciousness. I was always aware perceptually that I was there doing it. And when you're thinking about it, it doesn't. You know, the best players just went into a zone. You know, they went into this empty space and just acted almost robotically, like they've been dictated to by some godlike entity. And so I tried to. That was my interpretation of it anyway.
Yes.
And so I just mapped that onto this character of Arm. You could kind of switch off when he was just most physically immersed in the world, and yet the rest of the time is actually quite perceptive and sensitive, and he has love in his life and his son and his kind of ex girlfriend. And his relationship with his son, I mean, again, it's just, it was just inherently fascinating to me, all that some people can't articulate.
Yes.
Men especially, I suppose. They feel the thing, but they can't turn it into words. And Armin, I suppose, is one of them people. And so I wanted to sort of bring him to his sort of end point of that way. If you're not going to change, if you're just going to live in the physical world, but at the same time switched off, and you're never going to admit to your interiority, I think, you know, you're going to end up trapped one way, or, you know. So I suppose it had a weird logic to the story. I kept adding to it at the prompting of my couple of readers, because it was shorter initially, and I tried to make it. It was more just a sort of a day in the life kind of thing. But then perceptive readers pointed out there's a lot more here with the immediate circumstances you have. You have to push it on. And then when I kind of thought about it, I actually wrote the kind of back half of it pretty quickly. It had already been set up. And with longer pieces, you do get that. When you put the plot pieces in place, that kind of momentum takes over. And then it's just whether or not you're going to follow the path all the way to the end.
Yes, which you did. And there's a moment in the story where he's fatally wounded, but he can't forget his obligation to Dibner's family, and he goes, something had to be done one way or another, something had to be done that Arm could stand to call reparation. And I thought the fact that he could stand to call reparation had such a sort of biblical ring to it, sort of in the Old Testament sense of the word. And I just wondered if you could say something a little bit about the moral universe that these characters are orbiting in.
Well, it's a moral universe of sort of just intense tribalistic loyalty and familial affiliation. I mean, there's again in all the stories, I don't think there's any kind of conventional nuclear family, intact family. But there are in all the stories there are families
there are
of
clans.
One kind. There are clans. There's constructed. There's sort of improvised families of one way or another, and I suppose most.
Even the bands in the Boatman, that's a family.
Yeah, I mean, this is it. And I mean, most elaborately, I suppose, in Cam with Horses, because Aram works for Dimpna, who's a kind of, he comes from a family of settled kind of travellers in Ireland. So in the west, in Glanbey town, and Dimpna is essentially like a brother to him, and Dimpna has seven sisters, and Aram is essentially, but again, he has a That sort of, he feels that responsibility to Dimpna's family, and so when things go wrong, he does have to. He puts. I mean, this is what I was obviously trying to explore, but this maddening irrationality that makes sense to him of putting this loyalty, an abstract notion, which loyalty is, above his own welfare and the welfare of his actual immediate family as well. Yes. But he had to do it. It was his whole identity. That's, you know.
He had to put things right.
He'd try and put things right, even though he knew he wasn't going to put it right. But that's the kind of cruel logic of so much human action, you know.
Yes, it's almost mythical. This is raised to a kind of a Greek tragedy. This particular story, and I mentioned before all your main characters are men, and so I was very interested in the gender politics in your stories, because again there's a scene in Calm with Horses where Arm is at the town farm watching Jack and talking to his ex, and Rebecca the horse lady's there, and then Arm looked from woman to woman, their faces identically resolute, deadpan, just like that they had allied against him. And there's another line in the story, a couple of lines in the story where Powdy is talking about his brother Hector, and he's talking about the woman that Hector is involved with, and he said, she has him under her spell. He thinks he has her under his, but it's the other way around. And it seemed to me that women hold the power in these stories, that women have this extraordinary ability to render these men, they're at the mercy of many things, your characters, but they are always at the mercy of women.
I mean, the women... there's no story from the perspective of a woman, and I tried to write one, but I tried to write many, but they just weren't working out. It didn't sound credible to me, to my ear, you know. So unfortunately, I had to sort of try my best to get interesting women in there as background characters, and they have the power, but they kind of, it's that weird thing of they have all the responsibility. Men can act like little boys, and the women have to sort of clean up the mess, and they have to sort of endure through it, which gives them a stoic aspect that some of the men don't. And in Cam with horses, I mean, Aram is just this sort of, I mean, he's, on the one hand, he is a kind of passing imitation of the man, the silent man of action. You know, he beats people up, but he's kind of a, you know, he's another man-child. He's another species of man-child. He's another person who just can't, takes all the wrong things too seriously and doesn't take the serious things seriously enough. And yeah, his ex Ursula, again, they have a meaningful relationship, but she has to placate him as well, and sort of, you know, baby him a little bit. And Rebecca, his other potential love interest, just, you know, leaves him to himself. But yeah, women to some of these characters are, you know,
they seem to embody some kind of unfulfilled hope.
Yeah.
You know, Jimmy's looking to Marlene. Val is looking to Martina.
They're all just looking for mother figures or something, probably.
You know, there's Marianne in the final story who's died, and these two men are still yearning after her years after the event. But also they have this incredible power to be cruel. So in the story where Martina and his friend go looking for
Sarah.
He's looking for her, and then the narrator gets taken off into the woods. Teddy gets taken off into the woods by these women who
do him
I'm
over.
I'm not quite sure what they were doing to him. fairly brutal.
He got what he wants and then some. But yeah, I mean, the women are, you know, as they can sometimes appear to be to young men grown up, whose main experience is with each other, and maybe their mothers, and that's it, you know. So the women they offer this illusion of the deliverance, of getting out of their rut, their impasse, the limbo they're in. And it is an illusion, and, you know, that I think most of them know deep down it is only that. But the women kind of, I mean, again, they're incredibly enigmatic, capricious creatures who can shower you with affection or cruelty at the drop of a hat in this story, in these stories. But they too are just trying to negotiate this, you know, this cramped society, this higher, you know, and the hierarchies that obtain in these kind of small towns, and the roles that are expected of them. So the women have to be tough as well.
Well, they are. I think they're very interesting female characters. I'm looking forward to when you write a story from a female point of view, because I think you will.
I'm looking forward to it too, a successful one.
Great. Anne Enright said that your stories are set in familiar emotional landscapes, but they give us endings which are new. You've said a little bit about the shape of the story. You've said a little bit about the fact that you can pare things down in a short story form. Do you naturally arrive at an ending through the process of following the story's logic? How do you come upon your endings? Because I think your endings are surprising. In The Clancy Kid, we come upon a kind of a statement, which is kind of almost the theme of the story, which is we all have something we can't let go of. But we also have the characters turning around and seeing suddenly the children have vanished. And that's a very arresting visual image. And then, of course, in the end of Calm with Horses, we have the main character dying, which is quite shocking. So can you tell us how you work towards your final...
With some difficulty.
Yes, difficulty.
Some arrive, you know, you just arrive at the point. It's like you were on a train and late at night going through the, you know, the countryside, and you kind of convince yourself you're going to be there in half an hour, and you're going to arrive there awake, and then you kind of just lapse into a daydream or a little snooze, and then you wake up and you're already there, and you just step off the train. Some of them come like that. Others then is just writing and rewriting and rewriting and pulling things apart. Usually the ending is already in there.
Yes.
When I get to the original bad ending, or that, you know, I've gone too far or over explained things, or it's lost its inertia.
So it's almost a case of finding the ending within the story.
Going back and forensically finding it, yeah. I've never, like, I've heard, you know, some writers claim, I suppose novels as well as short stories, it's more difficult with short stories that they have the ending in mind.
Mm.
You know, they've conceived of an ending already. Yes. I sometimes have conceived of an ending or what I thought would be a good ending, and it's never worked out. The story's always died on the way. Mm. So I am someone who has to arrive at, I have to have written the rest of it. I have to have written the whole thing. I can work out a chronological order up until then, but I have to have written the whole thing before I can write the ending.
Yeah.
And again, it's because short stories are so, you know, I just keep going back to it, enigmatic.
Yes.
The best short story writer endings.
Are ones that resonate.
They just have that poetic sort of, just this impermeable nature. They're right there, you can see what they are. They leave you with some incredibly clear, vivid image.
Mm-hmm.
But it still retains a kind of an aspect of impenetrability, yeah, which is why it's so memorable. Yeah.
Thank you.
And that's what I aim for.
Yes. And that's what you achieve. And my final question is linked to that, I suppose, which is that I believe you're writing a novel.
Yes.
And I just wondered if you were finding that different in terms of your themes, in how you're expanding your environment, or if how you could explain that in relation to the short story.
Of course, yeah, it's different. It's totally different. Everything, the register of language, the you're kind of with a nine. I'm only in my early day. I'm in the early stages of writing. And I am writing it, so I'm very much an amateur here. I've never written a novel before, so I'm groping around. I've had to learn everything again. But yeah, I mean, with a novel, you're looking to, as you go along, to keep the narrative impetus. I mean, you kind of have to change things up, and whether that's a switch of perspective or to have a register of language that's sort of loose enough to sort of, you know, become sort of open and improvisational when it needs to, and then tighten up. Whereas with short stories, it's a sort of, it's an autonomous entity. It's all one thing. The register has to stay. You have to find the register, and it has to stay the same the whole way through. And the short stories, to me, don't so much as they appear to have a narrative, and some of them have quite a lot of narrative, a lot of story, but really they're just a sort of, they distill towards around a final, a concluding image, or they kind of distill concentrically around that. It's a sort of a refinement towards a refinement towards a sort of clear, hard kernel of an image. So they're incredibly different things. I'm just thinking there of like Chekhov's The Horse Thieves, The Horse Stealers, which is an unforgettable story once you've read it, with multiple unforgettable images in it. A novel is very different. You have to tell a story. You know, it's the silliest thing in the world. But the novel's a very fascinating form as well. So I'm having fun at the moment exploring its limits.
Great.
And hopefully I'll pull up something worth reading.
I'm sure you will, Colin. Thank you so much for sharing your process with us, and your ideas and your insights into your own work. And congratulations again on your success, and I look forward to reading your next work.
Cheers, thank you very much.